Occupy the Economy, and he has a show called Economic Update on WBAI, and I'm sure it's a good place to go to if you want to hear some dissident, non-Peterson Institute economic analysis. Thanks again. The folks are here, and they're in a good mood. They're all laughing at my silly jokes.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the June 23rd, 2012 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM radio, and also streamed worldwide at weft.org. The views and opinions expressed during this hour of programming are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WEFT's manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Sunday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, call area code 217-328-2295. That's Jobs with Justice, 328-2295. And this hour of programming is brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that they enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Thanks, Tom. I'm your host, Bob Pelesny, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us. And later in the show, during the Labor Hour Cultural Corner, Tom's poem of the week will be one from his book, Cries for Justice, and is titled, Seize the Sunlight. Also with us here today is Pat Simpson and also Bill Gorell, co-founder of the Illinois World Labor Hour many, many years ago. And Dave Johnson should be hopefully back next week. And so now here's Tom to kick off some labor interest news stories.
Hey, the Federal Reserve is trying again to jolt the American economy out of its stalled recovery. This time it is extending a program that aims to encourage borrowing and spending by reducing long-term interest rates. Wednesday's decision is a result of months of concern that the economy is being held back by a weakened job market. At the closure of the two-day policy meeting, the Fed also sharply reduced its forecast for U.S. growth and reported it is prepared to take more actions if necessary. But for the time being, it reiterated plans to keep short-term interest rates at record lows until at least late in 2014. According to Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, if we are not seeing a sustained improvement in the labor market, then that will require additional actions, although he did not specify what those actions would be. Wall Street was not impressed by the Fed's working. Stock prices barely budged, and analysts questioned how much benefit the Fed's latest economy-boosting efforts would have, in part because interest rates are already near historic lows. If the Fed's more pessimistic outlook proves accurate, President Obama's chances in an election that will run on the economy are also likely to suffer. Pat?
Thanks, Tom. This is an item from the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights, formerly the National Labor Committee. It's headlined, 500,000 workers strike in Bangladesh, ask Walmart to help. On Monday, July 11, 2012, thousands of workers in the Ashuila industrial zone on the outskirts of Dhaka, that's in Bangladesh, demanded an increase in their wages. At first, the workers walked out of 100 garment factories. By Friday, June 15th, all 350 factories in the area were shut down with 500,000 workers locked out. Police fired rubber bullets at the striking workers, turned powerful water cannons on them, and charged the workers, beating them with clubs. The powerful president of the Bangladesh Garment Manufacturers and Exporters Association, Mr. Shafiel Islam Muhuddin, said it was, quote, the factory owners who are being victimized in some conspiracy. Mr. Muhyiddin said the workers did not need a wage increase, that there is no logic for increasing the wages of the workers. In July 2010, the government and the BGME established a minimum wage of just 21 cents an hour, which was a far cry from the 43 cents an hour the workers needed. Over the last 2 years, steady inflation has weakened the purchasing power of the taka, which is Bangladesh's currency, by over 30%, according to labor leaders and rank-and-file workers. The 21 cent an hour minimum wage of 2010 is worth just 14.7 cents today. At a minimum, the workers are demanding a 30% wage increase, which would raise their wage by 6.3 cents, bringing the new minimum wage to 23.7 cents an hour. There is no garment corporation in the world that could not easily afford to pay at least 27.3 cents an hour as a minimum wage. The workers are planning a protest this Friday. This would have been, of course, just past June 22nd in Dhaka. What is decided on will determine Bangladesh's future. Working 12 to 16-hour shifts, 6 and 7 days a week, the Bangladeshi women are among the hardest workers in the world, but also the poorest. And so also, the organization is urging folks to send a letter to Michael Duke, the CEO of Walmart, which buys much of the goods that are produced from these factories, and urging them to urge those firms they're outsourcing with to agree to this wage increase. So you can actually get to that letter if you go to the Institute for Global Labor, that's LABOUR, and Human Rights Online.
Interesting. I got something that's sort of related here. The Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation here in the United States, concerned that workers at a failing steel company might be cheated out of their pensions, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Company, or PBGC, intervened last week to ensure that the company's owners don't misuse the bankruptcy courts to let themselves off the hook for more than $70 million owed to the employees. PBGC filed an objection in bankruptcy court June 14th to a temporary financing plan that would shield Renco Group Incorporated from pension liabilities of its subsidiary, RG Steel, LLC, their official owner of three troubled steel mills. RG Steel filed for bankruptcy May 31st and has since begun laying off some 4,000 workers at mills in Maryland, West Virginia, and Ohio. RG Steel and Renco are both controlled by billionaire Ira Rennert, who engineered a deal last year to buy the mills from the previous owner. Rennert is sometimes called a vulture capitalist, has announced his intention to sell the three plants to any buyer or buyers that can be found. A red flag was raised by PBGC in the initial bankruptcy filing, according to court documents, because the details of a temporary refinancing plan would release Renco from any liability to the underfunded pension plans for employees at the mills in Wheeling, West Virginia, and Warring, Ohio. The PBGC court filing charges that Renco and Ira Rennert, by implication, are trying to evade legal responsibility for the pension money owned about 1,381 workers at the Wheeling and Warren plants. Agency spokesman Mark Hopkins specifically stated that PBGC intends to pursue claims against Renco and affiliated companies for outstanding pension liabilities. They also stated that Renco appears to be guilty of bad faith in dealing with the pension agency. According to the court filing, in a transaction that took place in June 2012, Renco, contrary to express representations it made to PBGC, transferred 24.5% of its equity interest in RG Steel to affiliate or affiliates of Cerberus Capital Management LP. The transaction caused Renco's equity stake in RG Steel to fall below 80%, potentially releasing Renco from its financial obligations to the pension plans. And so that story came out Wednesday, in These Times. And then on Thursday, on the 21st, it was reported that RG Steel, the fourth biggest U.S. maker of flat-rolled steel, won court approval to hold an auction to sell virtually all of its assets. U.S. bankruptcy judge Kevin Carey in Wilmington, Delaware, today approved guidelines that would govern the asset sale. Carey also gave RG Steel permission to borrow up to $50 million to help fund operations while it pursues a sale. So they're just looking to get out of these pensions that they owe these people.
Absolutely. And I have, I guess, two comments on that. One is vulture capital. Is that sort of like Bain capital?
And I think it's
Mitt Romney. This is the kind of thing we saw from his firm. Obviously, not no exact parallels, but something similar. Asset stripping, as it were. And then the other comment I have is, gee, too bad the public sector workers of Illinois don't have a pension guarantee board to fight on their side.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, vulture capitalists, they've been known to go around and buy up these debts that countries owe and stuff for pennies on the dollar, and then sue these countries and stuff so that the country ends up having to pay them a bunch of money instead of paying the workers and the other people owed the money.
Yeah, unlike most people, my pension, and I assume, some of the billing trades don't have defined benefit pensions, but my pension is under no one entity's control. It's controlled by, there's no one. We have a whole bunch of contractors. You see, one contractor can take any pension. It's under the control of a board of trustees with representatives from the contractors and the union. You see, and there's no way that anybody could really, perhaps one of the accountants or something, one of the people who work for the firms could skim money off of it, but there's not really any way that any individual could do that.
I'm jumping back in here. I can't get away from this place. But, the ones that take over, the turnaround artists, they dump the pension plans, and then guess who pays for it? They go away with the money, and then it goes to this pension bureau. So the taxpayers are actually, if you look at how the money transfers, it means that Bain and these places, they actually are in a way, dumping these liabilities on the taxpayer. So
exactly. Yes. The PBGC is paid for by taxpayers' funds, and so we end up paying, and they get, I think, typically 30% of what they were promised originally, but that is all on the taxpayers' backs at that point in time. So
let's put this on the list of another example of corporate welfare.
Indeed.
Yes, and we let these billionaires off the hook, and we end up footing the bill, and the pensioners end up getting screwed
in the
long run. They
remain billionaires, and we remain poor.
Exactly, Tom. That pretty much sums it up. Got another story there, Tom?
An important project to open development opportunities north of the intersection of 4th Street and Bradley Avenue began last Wednesday. Crews are building an extension of North 4th Street, and the project is expected to be completed by September 14th, according to a city press release. Two of the four lanes on Bradley Avenue will necessarily be closed during the project, but through traffic will be maintained throughout the work. However, the narrow lane that connects Nathaniel Birch Drive will be closed for the duration of the work. The $490,000 project includes a 450-foot concrete extension of 4th Street and intersection improvements, including wider turning radii, new asphalt, new sidewalk ramps, new sidewalk lamps, and new street lights, and it's going to put some workers to work.
Ha ha, pygmy! It is radii. Pygmy was a rather diminutive finisher I was working with a few years ago, and he did not accept that the word radii existed. Because he is the person who would be forming those radii.
There ain't no such word as radius.
Is that like the plural of radio, radii?
Touche. I have a news item here that's about a union that I think is one of the most progressive unions of the moment and also involved in some really interesting, innovative things, and that's the National Nurses United. Yes. Among other things, they've been very active in the Occupy movement, particularly in the labor working group in Occupy Chicago, and doing some really, really very fine things. Most recently, they've been involved in a broad-based coalition movement in the United States, but it's also sweeping the globe, if you will, and that's the Robin Hood tax movement. And I'll read a little bit about a press release that came out recently about this. More than 6,000 nurses and activists gathered at Daly Plaza in Chicago Friday to rock out with musician Tom Morello and call for a tax on financial speculation, a Robin Hood tax. This small sales tax on Wall Street trades could add up to $350 billion a year in the U.S. money that American communities desperately need. It's time for Wall Street to start paying what all the rest of us pay, Karen Higgins, RN, told a cheering crowd, many wearing red nurse scrubs and green Robin Hood caps. Higgins, who works as a registered nurse in Boston, is co-president of the National Nurses United. As nurses, we see the economy as hurting families and communities across the country. They understand the suffering Americans face every day in health care, foreclosure, jobs, and education. I've been a nurse for 38 years, and I have never seen our communities in such disarray and in such suffering as I have seen in the last few years, said Deborah Berger, RN and NNU co-president. They got us into this mess, and they have the money to bail us out. Indeed, they do. Almost a quarter of the nation's GDP, close to $4 trillion, sits in corporate coffers, the largest cash hoard in U.S. history. And just to give you a little more information on what is a Robin Hood tax, essentially what it would be a tax on almost all financial transactions that big banks and related investment firms deal with.
A minuscule tax.
It's a minuscule tax. As a matter of fact, what they're talking about is a small tax of less than one-half of 1% on Wall Street transactions can generate hundreds of billions of dollars each year in the United States alone. And as I said, many other countries, the people in other countries, activists in other countries, are getting on this bandwagon, so it could apply elsewhere. And this would be enough to take care of many of the social needs that we have in this country. It would not affect ordinary Americans at all, their personal savings, et cetera, et cetera. I should mention that it's really exciting right now that folks that have signed on to this group, this movement include not only unions, we also see Jobs with Justice. There also are environmental groups that have gotten involved. And it's something I think that many of us should maybe take a look at. Just Google Robin Hood tax, and you can find out more.
I got a story about another union who maybe isn't quite as progressive as the nurses there. Again, this story's out of In These Times, and this is the great labor reporter Mike Elk. He reports on Thursday, Lee Saunders, secretary treasurer of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, asked me, defeated CSEA Local 1000 President Danny Donahue by more than 100,000 delegate votes. Ask Me does not vote in a direct election for its president, but through delegates representing members, and he's going to become the union's fourth president in 75 years. Saunders will become the first African-American president of the 1.3 million member Ask Me, whose famous 1968 Memphis sanitation workers' strike was being supported by Martin Luther King at the time of his assassination. The election of the 60-year-old Saunders was backed by outgoing Ask Me's president Gerald McEntee, will likely mean that many of the current top headquarters staff of Ask Me will stay in place and that Ask Me will maintain a similar course to that plotted under McEntee in recent years. Donahue pledged to continue working with Saunders to improve the union. However, there's some dissatisfaction with that. Chicago Ask Me Local 2858 President Steve Edwards, a Donahue supporter, wrote in an email, "We have forgotten not only how to use our real weapons of withdrawing our labor in various ways. Instead, we imagine that collecting money for the People Fund, which is a political action fund, can buy us power, which it can't. We had the opportunity to take on Scott Walker through a general strike, but instead Ask Me led the retreat into the recall campaign, which, if it had worked, could only have benefited the Democrats," said Edwards, who feels the union hasn't fully grasped the role Democrats have played in hurting public sector workers. Edwards was particularly dismayed by the removal of language critical of Obama Secretary of Education Arne Duncan for his attacks on teachers' unions in a motion defending public education. So the song remains the same, it asked me.
Yeah, it remains the same, but it also, the tension and the fight over the presidency and the succession, if you will, certainly is reflective of a very serious debate that is going on in unions at this point, and that is, what is the relationship to electoral politics? What is the relationship to the Democratic Party? And more particularly, questions, I think, about the labor bureaucracy in general, questions about what should be appropriate pay. McEntee, many people would say, for too long, actually ran the union from his house on the shores of the Atlantic coast in Florida, and it raises, I think, some real serious questions about, again, this issue of where do we go from here.
Yeah, something interesting about McEntee was that he's generally been kind of American laborers. I hesitate to say American labor movement. Spokesperson, media person, him and Richard Trumka. Not so much since they were both caught up in the Teamster fundraising scandal with Ron Carey way back when. They were popping up all the time, but I have seen McEntee some in recent years. But they're the only people, you know, maybe you see or hear perhaps Leo Girard.
Right.
But, I mean, you know, my parents would tell me, and their salad days were during the Depression. John L. Lewis was as famous as Clark Gable, Will Rogers, you know, name anybody you want, FDR. He was one of the greatest celebrities of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I would bet you could go to a construction job, a union construction job here in this town, and it's possible you could find nobody who knows who Richard Trumka is easily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just shocking. I mean, and that's one of the reasons these guys can get away with a lot of stuff, too, because nobody's reporting on them.
We are.
Well, yeah.
But we've come to that time in the program, and it's time for Tom's poem for this week in the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. And his poem from his book, Cries for Justice, is titled, Seize the Sunlight.
If our Mother Earth is dying from the ignorance of mankind, don't you think we should start working to be the saviors of our kind? There are jobs to be created, and we had better start them soon. Our Earth's just getting dirtier, and cleaning her would be a boon. Reduce the use of fossil fuels, seize the sunlight, harness the wind, build solar disks and high windmills that we may not soon see our end. To cleanse our lands and waters, too, will require workers to work, from paving pitted city streets to cleansing the Gulf waters murk. So many thousands of workers, green jobs could put back on the job, and each could feed their families, never knowing a hungry sob. As soon as we send less missiles to the other side of our earth, and spend those billions of dollars enhancing we working folks' worth. Seize the Sunlight was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois in the spring of 2011 and was brought to you live today, June 23rd, 2012, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Thanks, Tom. A couple public service announcements for us this week. As always, we want to remind you about Labor's View TV, local cable channel 6, Sunday and every Sunday at 4 p.m. features a host of this show, David Johnson, and also a friend of the show, Jim Hyman, and they've always got some great discussion and videos on that show. That's Sunday, this Sunday, every Sunday, local cable channel 6 at 4 p.m. And also want to mention that WEFT is a co-sponsor and going to be an MC of the 2012 Blues, Brews, and Barbecue Festival. That's going on next Friday, June 29th, and Saturday, June 30th. And it's going to be right around the corner here at Walnut and Main in downtown Champaign. And for more information, you can go to bluesbrewsandbbqfest.com. It's going to have some great blues acts from around the country here. Nick Moss coming out of Chicago, putting on a super jam on Saturday night, the Royal Southern Brotherhood, which features Devin Allman, Mike Zito, and Cyril Neville, plus there'll be a lot of other people, Tinsley Ellis, John Namath, Lightning Malcolm will be here from Mississippi, all kinds of people, going to be Eddie Turner, a lot of local groups too, the Diva and the Dude, and Alex Jenkins and the Bombers, Hurricane Root, Bill, you got something there?
So what, Champagne somehow outbid Urbana for that this year?
Evidently, they got a little bit of extra money from the Champagne Convention and Visitors Bureau.
And I got some advice for you, and that is really make... one time, you know, when Ike used to have the big shows out at the Malibu. Anyway, this is sort of local inside baseball, folks, if you're streaming us from the West Coast or something. But anyway, I was chair of the Public Relations Committee, and we had arranged to MC that show. And I ended up introducing every band except for the headliner. And nobody from WEFD did that because Dot wanted to introduce him. Yeah. I think it was Bobby Blue Bland.
Yeah. Mick's been hard at work this last week lining up various blues airshifters and other airshifters here at WEFD.
Yeah, see, I just assumed they'd be there for the most of the show, but most of them didn't show up until
I think we got quite a few of the bands covered, and I actually believe a different radio station gets to do the headliners on both nights or whatnot. But yeah, we've got a pretty solid crew of blues fans here at WEFT that are all volunteered to introduce most of these different bands. So.
Well, I got another music-related thing, but it's not local. This is from Ann Feeney. It's her fellow traveler's newsletter. And she goes, I can hardly believe I'm going back on the road again. I fervently hope that my health has been restored and that I'll be able to get back with my life and work. Oh, sorry, folks. But anyway, we'll Ann's going to be touring the West Coast in July.
Okay, sounds great. I think our caller is calling in here. We'll go right to John Ryman.
Good morning.
John, how you doing?
Okay, how's it going with you?
Excellent. It's good to have you on the show. You want to give us just a brief reintroduction, John? You're one of our favorite guests here, but you should give us a one or two sentence introduction of who you are and what you've been responsible for.
Well, I'm the retired carpenter and the former recording secretary in the Carpenters Local out here, and I'm an expelled member of the Carpenters Union. I was expelled for leading a wildcat strike, and I'm a member of the Industrial Workers of the World. So is that enough?
That's enough, John.
Cool.
It's always a pleasure to have you on the show here. I think one of the issues we were going to talk to you about was Greek elections.
Right.
Well, if you want to kick that off.
Well, it's when you put it in perspective, it's quite incredible what happened there. Here you have this tiny peninsula nation whose population is barely more than half the population of greater Mexico City that threw just about the entire capitalist world into turmoil with this recent election. Stock markets all around the world were plunging because they didn't know who was going to win it. And the entire, world capitalist class was worried about and was discussing this election.
I believe CNBC had a special program last Sunday night just so that they could live talk about the results of the Greek election because they were so concerned about what might happen over there.
Exactly. And a friend of mine here was telling me he was watching, I forget which channel, one of the main TV channels out here, and they had some special on the election in which they said that one of the parties, and they never would mention which, one of the parties wants to cut your pension plans. That's talking about cutting your pension here in the United States. And it shows the fear that they had. Of course, the party that they were talking about was Syriza, which is a coalition of different left forces, which just actually recently formally declared itself as an official political party in Greece. But what happened is that, you know, they've had these austerity measures in Greece as they have had in several different Western European countries, Italy, Spain, and so on, Portugal, for the last several years, and as they've had in many different countries, there have been huge protests against these austerity plans. And by austerity, we mean, of course, laying off public sector workers, cutting pensions and other and cutting social services, reducing the minimum wage, and basically making different sectors of the working class pay for the crisis of the economic system as a whole. And in all these different countries, there have been huge, massive protests, general strikes. They've basically shut down the country, destabilized things for whole long periods. And these protests have been unable to prevent the austerity plans from going through. But in Greece, what happened was that the protests then led to the development of a mass left anti-austerity political force, Syriza.
Right.
And that's been, and nobody is saying, at least I'm not saying, that street protests, general strikes, and so on are not an essential ingredient in building a workers' movement. They are an essential ingredient. But there's another ingredient that's also essential, and that is the formulation of a clear policy and the development of the workers' movement into an organized political force. And that's what Syriza represented, although I think that there were some confusions and are some confusions within Syriza, but we can get to that in a minute. But anyway, the main thing that Syriza and its leadership pledged was, we are not going to carry out the austerity plans, the cuts and the wage cuts and layoffs that the previous governments have agreed to. And that's what threw terror into the capitalist class throughout Western Europe and throughout the world.
Hi, John. This is Bill Gorell.
Hi, Bill.
I know it obviously would not be so severe here, but aren't we going through a different way of doing austerity ourselves, such as through the state governments, like, you know, what's going on in Wisconsin? And also, I just Googled federal government jobs cuts 2012, and here's the headlines that you get. Government job cuts threaten black middle class, NPR. Government job loss, President Obama's catch 22 from ABC News. Threat from mounting public job losses tested Obama's economic, then from the Washington Post. I mean, it's not as bad, perhaps, as it is in Europe, but we're doing sort of a similar thing. And in order to do the same thing, which is kind of basically pay the bankers and bondholders.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, absolutely. I don't think that there's a country in the entire world that isn't going through these similar kinds of austerity measures, and in some places it's sharper and more severe than others. But yeah, here in the United States, this has been going on for several decades now, hasn't it?
Well, in fact, remember Al Gore was sort of the czar for re-engineering government in the 90s, and I believe they laid off 150,000 people or so.
Well, here in Oakland, we're now having a struggle around the closure of several public schools. And, of course, the whole Occupy movement, really what spurred it was this same sort of austerity, isn't it? And
yes.
The thing is, it's interesting that there's some of the forces in the Occupy Oakland out here that are now talking about running people for office. So you can see the same sort of thing developing on a very small scale in all different parts of the world as far as it becoming directly a political movement.
You know, John, we had some people from the ISO on last week, International Socialist Organization, and I came across a poll that I had seen last week that from European countries that said only 10% of the people in those countries favored these austerity programs and thought that they would work to bail these countries out. So this is just an indication that these politicians are doing the exact opposite of what the people really want them to do.
That was the top 10%, huh?
Well, yes.
Well,
yeah, I just wanted to... This is Pat Simpson here, John. How are you?
Hi.
To give people also a sense of what's going on in places like Greece, I think the unemployment rate there now is about 24%. I mean, we're talking about, actually, I think that those were the estimates for the United States unemployment rate in quote unquote the Great Depression. But going back to Syriza for a second, what's their position on Greece remaining in the European Union?
And well, there's the European Union and then there's the Eurozone, as we know, which is most of the countries in the European Union have a most, but not all, have a common currency, which is the euro. And I think the polls in Greece show that something like 80% of the Greek population want to remain within the eurozone, that is, to keep the euro as their currency. And this gets back to a fundamental contradiction of the euro itself, and because the dominant powers in the eurozone, mainly the German regime, are saying that if Greece does not abide by the austerity measures that its governments have agreed to, that they will be kicked out of the eurozone. They'll have to have their own return to their own currency, the drachma. And if that were to happen, then prices in Greece of imported goods, including like fuel oil, fuel, cooking oil, and so on, would skyrocket. So they're kind of in a situation, in one sense, of damned if they do and damned if they don't. And the leadership of Syriza says, no, we want to stay in the euro, in the eurozone. And we think that that Merkel, the head of the German government, and the others are just bluffing, and they wouldn't dare kick us out of the euro. But I don't think that that's necessarily true. And I think that a lot of Greek voters didn't think that was necessarily true. And that's why Syriza came very close to winning this election of just last weekend, but the main capitalist party, New Democracy, came out on top. And I think that when you look at the whole idea of the euro, that there's a basic contradiction there, there's a basic problem, because you have a currency for a whole series of different nations, but you can't really unite under capitalism. You cannot really unite all these nation states, because a currency requires certain fiscal policies, and you can't have the same economic and fiscal policies under capitalism for a whole series of different countries. If you take, just in this particular case, look at Greece. Labor productivity in Greece is something like 25% below what it is in the on the average for the different eurozone nations. So that in itself, it makes this huge economic difference. And in the good times, in the times of economic expansion, they can kind of paper over that conflict. But in this period, they can't.
Yeah, I think that has been something that has been observed. And, of course, now it's led to some discussion about, in order to really make the euro and the European Union work and function, there has to be even greater administrative consolidation and centralization. But you're absolutely right. That, I don't think, is going to go over in many of these countries at this particular point in time.
Not
well,
what do you
mean by greater centralization and greater consolidation? That basically, I think that the euro is going to go in one of two directions. Either Greece is going to fall out of it, followed by other countries, and the whole euro will either collapse entirely, or it'll be confined to a very few of the top nations, Germany, maybe France, and one or two others. Either that, or they'll have what they call greater consolidation. But what does that really mean? It means a WTO, World Trade Organization, style consolidation, where you have appointed so-called technical experts, which means really direct control over the economic policies by the bankers, rather than by elected representatives.
Yeah, and they already have a bit of this, and as an example of the downside of centralization, the head of the European Central Bank is a former Goldman Sachs executive, and more recently they came up with policies that essentially reduced loan rates to the banks and financial houses within Europe, and therefore to some extent globally, while they essentially have kept interest rates high, of course, for these nations that are struggling at this particular point in time. As a matter of fact, it's high interest rates that have put them in the bind that they're in.
So they've had a hard time you know, what we've seen over the last 20 years has been an acceleration of the working class in one part of the world or in one nation competing against workers in another nation for who will work for cheaper. And they've had a very hard time drawing the Western European workers into that competition, what we all know is the race to the bottom. And if they can consolidate the power of the centralized power, centralize the euro, as you were talking about, if they can do that, that's what they will be doing. They'll be cutting wages, they'll be cutting workers' rights, they'll be cutting social services and so on, and increasingly draw the Western European workers into that race to the bottom. That's what that's really all about. And the other side, though, is, I mean, we have to see the dangers of the that are implied by the breakup of the euro or the potential breakup of it. And if you just remember that in order to unify Germany, just one nation, there was something like a half dozen different wars fought. And the history of Western Europe as a whole is a history of wars, isn't it? Not just World War One and World War Two, but going all the way back to the days of Napoleon and even before that. And you can see now the tensions starting to break out between German and French capitalism, for instance, and as we know, that's not exactly unheard of in history. And so it's not just an economic crisis, but as this crisis develops and as Europe tends to be kind of drawn apart, the dangers of war will again be reintroduced there.
There was a soccer match yesterday in Europe, in Poland,
right,
actually, between Germany and Greece, and there was an awful lot of political implications just in that soccer match.
There was if anybody gets a chance to see the front page of today's Wall Street Journal, it was absolutely hilarious. It was tongue-in-cheek, but there was a big picture of Merkel, as those who follow soccer know, Germany defeated Greece.
Right.
And there was a big picture, and Merkel, who's a big soccer fan, was at the stadium. And there's a big picture of her jumping up and down, waving her arms in the air, and it says, Germany kicks Greece out of the Euro, or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, the Euro Cup, yeah.
Right. And it's, anyway, so, I mean, there's no realm of life which isn't touched by this. And as I say, you know, I mean, I think that we here have to start to draw some conclusions by the importance of what Syriza has done. And just they're simply saying, look, we are not going to carry out this austerity. Let the bankers pay for it. You know, that's an important message, especially when it's not confined to just protesting against what others are doing, but when you're struggling to have some power to do things yourself. And those of us who are socialists or anti-capitalists, you know, at least for myself, most of us, you know, we would agree that running people for office in the capitalist elections, that's not an act of revolution. But neither is going on strike. But these things are necessary. They're part of building a movement through which working people can take power ultimately.
As you say, it's not just there in Greece. I have a story here that I didn't get to today about the miners in Spain that are protesting austerity measures, both in northern Spain and the miners in southern Spain that are in sympathy with them. 40,000 miners are protesting austerity measures, and the police are clamping down on them.
Right.
In France, there were just recent elections, and the socialist parties did very well in the French elections.
Right. I would like to raise one other point that I think everybody that we need to think about, and that is some disagreements that I think, or some issues that I think have to be raised about the one questionable aspect of what the Syriza leadership is saying. Because while they're saying we are not going to impose austerity, that we simply refuse to accept that, And that is an extremely important message. Nobody should underestimate the importance of it. But you also have, for instance, one person who was quoted, who was identified by the Wall Street Journal as a senior spokesman for Syriza, said that what they want to do is, quote, calm the markets, meaning the stock markets. And the leader of Syriza, Tsipras himself, writing in the London Financial Times, called for bringing Greece into a new era of growth and prosperity. And he's saying that they don't want to pick a fight with finance capital, but convince them. And the main economic advisor to Syriza, George Stathakis, was quoted as saying that his party was avowedly pro-Europe and wanted to keep the single currency, but the terms of the bailout were stifling growth. And what all of that, if you take it together, is saying is that basically that we think that some grounds can be found to solve this problem within the realm of capitalism itself. And I think that that's mistaken. I think, you know, especially in this period, you have this economic crisis in capitalism, and there is no solution to it short of a real disaster, you know, within the bounds of capitalism. And, you know, what you've also seen already before, when it looked like Syriza might win the election, you had people who had deposits in Greek banks. They were withdrawing millions of euros per day and sending it out of the country because they were worried that those deposits that were in euros might be transformed into drachmas and suddenly they would be worth a lot less. And if Syriza had won the elections, that would have become an absolute avalanche of withdrawal of money from Greece. So you have that on the one hand. On the other hand, you have the rise, I'm sure you've heard of this, it really is a fascist party, Golden Dawn, which is physically attacking immigrants in Greece and so on. So on the one hand, you know, you're running for office, which is the right thing to do. But on the other hand, I think that you have to start developing an alternative centers of workers' power and workers' control outside of the state bureaucracy. For instance, have Greek the workers in the Greek banks actually start to take control over the banks and to prevent this flood of money from leaving the country, and develop worker defense teams that links up the Greek workers with the immigrants in Greece to combat this fascist force. And, you know, I'm not one to use the term fascism just to call anybody from Ronald Reagan to Lord knows who a fascist. These are people who, for instance, have openly supported Hitler and so on.
So, is there any indication that parties in Syriza, individuals within Syriza or groups within Syriza are doing any of that sort of thing at this point?
You know, I don't know, and I wish I had been in Greece. You know, I'd like to go there, but I would be surprised if there weren't elements within Syriza that don't, that aren't questioning this, you know. And who knows, maybe even the leadership of Syriza can be convinced of a different approach, you know. But anyway, this side of it has to be considered also, I think.
Oh, by the way, John, this is Bill again, and I was thinking that a lot of this austerity is thought necessary to pay off bondholders so that they would not lose confidence and that they would continue to finance governments in general. Could this come to a crisis in Greece, maybe, where they finally just say to hell with the bondholders and decide on another way of doing business, of organizing their economy?
Well, that's another thing that's been raised, is don't pay the debt. And as you know, at one point in Argentina, that's what they did.
Well, Iceland. And nobody's really picking on Iceland for anything. Is that because they live up way north and they're all really white?
I think Iceland is also a little bit more isolated. But when Iceland, when they first took that step, the economy absolutely collapsed. Then it did somewhat recover. So, I mean, I think that, yes, don't pay off the debt to these bankers who have made their money back many times over just in the interest payments alone. But that also has certain implications, and it seems to me the implications are that the follow-up step has to be to take finance capital out of private hands and put it in public hands where this enormous mass of wealth that is owned and controlled by the working class itself, and then we can decide what to do with it. Otherwise, it's a club that's going to constantly be held over our heads.
Yes.
I have one last question. We're getting close to the end here, but I wanted to ask, do you have any sense of what the German unions are saying about this situation at this particular point in time, like IG Metall or any of those unions?
You know, that is a great question, and as far as the unions themselves, I don't know. From what I've been told, a lot of Germans have, there's been a huge propaganda campaign in Germany that, oh, the Greeks are just lazy, they don't work hard, they're spendthrifts, they're all cheating on their on their taxes, and they want you, German workers, to pay for their bad habits. And, I mean, we know that propaganda campaigns like that can have an effect.
It'd be interesting to see if any of the unions are doing kind of a counter-narrative at all in that.
That's right. I mean, the other thing is I think Syriza should be sending teams of workers and youth all throughout the EU and, in fact, beyond there, just explaining what this is all about, that this austerity is part of the race to the bottom, and that we all have to join together. We can't fight it one nation of workers by one like that. We have to join together to have a common strategy and common goals. And in that way, start to build direct links between the workers in different countries and different parts of the world.
The problem is we haven't even been able to do that here in the United States from state to state as our states are racing to the bottom.
Well, that's true to an extent, but like you had a lot of people from different states go to Wisconsin a year and a half ago for the big struggle there. So it's true to an extent, and part of it is, you know, our own union leaders accept that austerity is supposedly necessary. And so they're not going to build that kind of struggle. And I think that, you know, what's needed within the unions is to start to build, I'm talking about the mainstream unions now, to start to build opposition caucuses and groupings within the unions. And yes, they should be demanding that their union leaders organize this sort of thing, but they don't have to wait to do that. I mean, what would it really take for GM and Ford workers to get a little group of workers to go and visit their counterparts in Mexico and Canada?
Good thoughts there, John. Once again, we always appreciate having you on the show. It's a pleasure. And we're kind of running out of time, but we really appreciate you calling in on a frequent basis, and I'm sure we'll have you on again here shortly.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks.
Bye, John.
Thanks, John.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. And Bill, did you have that little last little bit about Ann Feeney there? Or?
Oh, I'm sorry.
So nice to know she's walking the road.
Uh-oh.
Oh.
Well, anyway, I closed my notebook, and now it's going to have to wake up. But anyway, okay. Ann seems to be doing well. She's going to tour. She's touring the West Coast. If you want to know more, I would just Google Ann Feeney. That's A-N-N-E-F-E-E-N-E-Y.
Correct.
I believe it is EY.
EY, correct, yes.